From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. The Cuban Missile Crisis, 13 of the most frightening days in history. Do you remember it? I was too young in 1962, and maybe you were too, but we of course learned about it later in history classes. And this week's 50th anniversary has been an opportunity to understand what it was like to live in America then and how our president, John F. Kennedy, ultimately averted nuclear war. Our senior news editor, Alan Ray, today brings us some of President Kennedy's famous speech made during the crisis. And Dr. Joseph Palermo, an associate professor of history at Sacramento State, joins us. He's written two books on Robert F. Kennedy, and his teaching does focus on the 1960s. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you.
So, Alan, I'd like you to set the stage for us, and it starts with famous photos.
Sunday, October 14th, 1962, an American U-2 spy plane flies over an area called San Cristobal in Cuba. The pilot takes 928 pictures. Monday, October 15th, analysis of the pictures shows four Soviet mobile missile launchers capable of firing SS medium-range nuclear missiles. More intelligence gathering reveals 42 nuclear missiles scattered across 10 locations in Cuba. October 15th marks the beginning of the 13 days we know as the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I'm going to pause you right there.
Yes.
Because I'm going to ask Dr. Palermo to jump in and say, at this point, the chess moves have already started back and forth, haven't they?
Well, they were looking at this John Kennedy formed this executive committee, right, that they call XCOM, that which is all the top brass and foreign policy officials to kind of deliberate and look at the intelligence and try to formulate a response from the U.S., you know, and they recorded a lot of it. A lot of the recordings exist. And so it's just this treasure trove of actually what they were thinking at the time. And it was certainly a chess game in that, initially, those XCOM tapes show that everybody was pretty much ready to invade and bomb Cuba right away because they didn't want the missiles to become operational and this kind of thing. Then they had to contemplate what the responses would be. There's the chess game for you. Like, obviously, the Kennedys had already basically with the Bay of Pigs a year earlier, April 61, they had launched this kind of CIA invasion of Cuba in the beginning, you know, in the first place, which kind of prodded Khrushchev to want to put missiles there as a way to ensure that the regime wasn't toppled by the U.S. So it was when they got the initial reports, they were trying to figure out not only if the missiles were operational and how many they had, what was going on down there, but then how are they going to respond? And initially, they wanted to bomb and invade right away. Almost everybody on the committee.
And at that point, the conversations and the communication are very internal. Was it leaking out a little bit to the American public?
They were actually very good at keeping this under wraps until Monday, October 22nd, when John Kennedy went on television to announce the policy, the response.
And Alan, you can pick up the story there.
Well, over the next week, the president meets with his advisors, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Soviet diplomats who continue to insist that the Soviet military facilities on Cuba are defensive. They continue to say that. Monday, October 22nd, 4 o'clock West Coast time in the afternoon, President Kennedy delivers an 18-minute national television address.
The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area. Additional sites not yet completed appear to be designed for intermediate range ballistic missiles, capable of traveling more than twice as far, and thus capable of striking most of the major cities in the Western Hemisphere, ranging as far north as Hudson's Bay, Canada, and as far south as Lima, Peru. In addition, jet bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons are now being uncrated and assembled in Cuba, while the necessary air bases are being prepared. This urgent transformation of Cuba into an important strategic base by the presence of these large, long-range, and clearly offensive weapons of sudden mass destruction constitutes an explicit threat to the peace and security of all the Americas.
Dr. Palermo, for America not knowing by and large what was going on and then hearing that speech, what was the shockwave like?
Well, the context of the speech is that the country had been steeped in Cold War anti-communism, children ducking under their desks with the duck and cover drills. We had a bomb shelter craze going on. The Soviets had ignited a 57 megaton bomb a year earlier in October 61. Mm. There were runs on stores buying canned goods, and people were buying batteries, and all over the, especially in the southeast, around the Florida area. Some of the members of XCOM later on, about a week into it, they told John Kennedy that if the Soviets did get some of the missiles launched, that they could kill 30 million Americans in the southeast of the country.
Mm.
If they attacked the island and some were launched. You know.
Well, it would be one thing if that was all the president said, but then the president went on.
Well, yeah. He twice said the Soviets had lied to him about the nature of the missile installations on Cuba. And it turns out in a meeting on October 19th, the Air Force Chief of Staff, Curtis LeMay, had urged the president to bomb the Cuban missile sites. The Defense Secretary, Robert McNamara, recommended a naval blockade of the island. And in his speech 3 days later, President Kennedy announced a quarantine of Cuba to prevent the entry of any more offensive weapons.
Our own strategic missiles have never been transferred to the territory of any other nation under a cloak of secrecy and deception. And our history, unlike that of the Soviets since the end of World War II, demonstrates that we have no desire to dominate or conquer any other nation or impose our system upon its people. Nevertheless, American citizens have become adjusted to living daily on the bullseye of Soviet missiles located inside the USSR or in submarines. In that sense, missiles in Cuba add to an already clear and present danger. Although it should be noted, the nations of Latin America have never previously been subjected to a potential nuclear threat. But this secret, swift, extraordinary buildup of communist missiles in an area well known to have a special and historical relationship to the United States and the nations of the Western Hemisphere, in violation of Soviet assurances and in defiance of American and hemispheric policy, this sudden, clandestine decision to station strategic weapons for the first time outside of Soviet soil is a deliberately provocative an unjustified change in the status quo, which cannot be accepted by this country. If our courage and our commitments are ever to be trusted again by either friend or foe.
We are listening to history from 50 years ago, reflecting on those words from President John F. Kennedy as he speaks to the nation about the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're talking with our senior news editor, Alan Ray, and Sac State history professor and author, Joseph Palermo. Alan, what a phenomenal speech.
And completely without teleprompters, all of it, and no audience. It was, you can go back and take a look even on YouTube and see the speech, black and white. The president, they could have shot this with one camera and barely a flinch. And you had to know that his insides had to be roiling with what was going on, the tension that had to be mounting over the course from basically from the 14th or the 15th. On up a week now, this has been going on. There's all kinds of back-channel communications going on, meetings with the United Nations, meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Well, that phrase he uses, living daily in the bullseye.
In the bullseye, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, continue on.
Yeah, the president lays out 7 points, beginning with that quarantine. He says any nuclear missile launched at any target in the Western Hemisphere would be taken as an attack on the U.S. and would bring what he called a full response.
We have no wish to war with the Soviet Union, for we are a peaceful people who desire to live in peace with all other peoples. But it is difficult to settle or even discuss these problems in an atmosphere of intimidation. That is why this latest Soviet threat, or any other threat, which is made either independently or in response to our actions this week, must and will be met with determination. Any hostile move anywhere in the world against the safety and freedom of peoples to whom we are committed, including in particular the brave people of West Berlin, will be met by whatever action is needed.
There were Soviet attempts to breach the quarantine. On Saturday, October 27th, A U-2 spy plane was shot down over Cuba by a Soviet surface-to-air missile. Its pilot, the Air Force Major Rudolf Anderson, was the only known fatality in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Some Kennedy advisors still wanted to bomb the missile sites, but the next day, Sunday, October 28th, the Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev sent a message to Washington that the missiles would be removed from Cuba and the Soviet offensive facilities would be dismantled. And historians say that is the closest we ever got to World War III.
Dr. Palermo, how did we avert that crisis? How did it end like that, so abruptly and so completely?
Well, John Kennedy, they sensed that the military action, once they told him, this is about a week into it, and once Curtis LeMay and the brass, when they told him that some of these missiles would be fired, in other words, they said, we'll bomb the island. Well, can you get them all? Well, they all know some of them will probably be fired. Well, what does that mean? Oh, it could be 30 million people. And then John, at that point, he used Robert F. Kennedy, his brother, the attorney general, as kind of a secret back channel to... There's a journalist named Georgi Bolshakov who he was meeting with, and he also met with Dobrynin, the ambassador in secret. And they offered to remove the Jupiter missiles, which were kind of old anyway, from Turkey that the United States had there that could hit the Soviet Union in about the same amount of time. Now, what's really chilling about this is they understood that their tactical nuclear weapons on the island are enough to about the size of a Hiroshima bomb that can be used to detonate over the heads of the Marines. If they were going to talk about sending 18,000 Marines in on the beaches. Now, and then he said if any detonation of a nuclear weapon in the Western Hemisphere would be considered attack on the United States, requiring this full retaliatory response. But they didn't know at the time, but they had 98 tactical nuclear weapons on the island.
That was the key piece of information that we learned later from Robert Kennedy's papers.
Well, the 13 days which came out was his diaries that he kept during the period, which have been, historians have been going over that and the tapes, and there's actually some new documents that come out, and they're showing that, he put the best face on it from the early on. They were all pretty hawkish. They were more hawkish than they let on later. We were never really contemplating, going in and bombing the island. But they had contingency plans. They even had the State Department draw up a new government for Cuba. They were ready to overthrow Castro. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about that, they had the perfect pretext to overthrow Castro. And Castro was the Congress passed a resolution calling for his ouster by like 380-7 in the House and almost unanimous in the Senate, something like 98-0, right? The bipartisan anti-Castro sentiment was really strong. And so John and Robert Kennedy were working in this kind of really heightened Cold War, atmosphere, but they understood that these nuclear weapons were not to be trifled with and that you had to give Khrushchev a face-saving way out of it. You couldn't just try to make him back down. Now, he did, with that quarantine, Khrushchev did back down. They turned the ships around and they didn't try to, run the quarantine stuff. And so Khrushchev, he sends these letters. He sent one letter there's two letter, famous letters that came where he concedes, like, let's untie this knot of war that we've and Khrushchev is holding his hardliners at bay in the Kremlin. Kennedy's holding Curtis LeMay and these hardliners here in the United States. And they work out this secret deal where the United States is going to give up the Jupiter missiles and pledge not to invade the island, which they did publicly, right? So, and then if they removed it. So they took everything that the Soviets, but there was 162 warheads there. They didn't realize that until about the 90s after these documents came out. Robert McNamara called it dumb luck that we didn't have a nuclear war because of the communication snafus and, Rudolf Anderson being shot down. They shot down the U-2. They fired on other American planes, too.
Alan is nodding like I'm sure so many people are listening to this right now, remembering, even though we didn't know the step-by-step, remembering what it felt. And I wonder how many people were reminded of it as we listened to the third presidential debate. And some of the words and the messages in that debate harken right back to this speech and the messages we were trying to give the world at that point in time, our desire for peace.
You don't have a sense of what it was like to live in a world where there were every Tuesday, depending, or Wednesday, depending on where you were, Thursday at noon or 2 o'clock or whatever your city decided on, there was an air raid. And you were in school, you got onto your desk. Mm. And you had to do it. Yeah,
the practice
talking
drills.
About the bomb shelters. Oh yes, we had a basement that mm-hmm. was fully stocked with canned goods,
mm-hmm.
and this was before there was much bottled water. So my parents would put 5-gallon bottles of water with enough Clorox in it, enough mm-hmm. bleach in it, to make sure the water stayed good.
Do you remember being afraid as a child?
I don't remember being afraid. I knew something bad was happening, and I was living up in Tacoma, Washington, where there was McCord Air Force Base, there was Fort Lewis, and there was the Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. And we were not quite as close as Sarah Palin was, but, you know, in the summertime, late in the summertime, you could see light that far north.
Yeah.
So you knew we were that close to where there were Soviet missiles that could be getting us, and we were a target.
Dr. Palermo, no other time as close to this in our history. Do you envision we could ever be this close again?
Oh, sure, certainly.
You do.
Because more nations have the bomb now. So
yeah, and that's where the focus of conversation is about Iran and exactly right. what we do with them as a country and the weaponry.
I think that John Kennedy showed, they had managed crises with these southern governors at that same time. Just a month before, they were managing the whole Mississippi integration, University of Mississippi with James Meredith. So they understood about giving a southern governor a face-saving way out or mm-hmm. trying to manage it in a way where I think it's a test case for successful crisis management after the fact. In other words, a lot of historians blame Kennedy for getting up to that point with the brinkmanship in the first place, you know. But once they were in that predicament, it's a test case in how to solve a really thorny diplomatic problem through incremental steps that do not lead to war. You know, at the end of the day, we're here to talk about it. So they did successfully defuse the conflict. And I'm grateful that Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy were in power at that moment.
Right. And that's the perfect place to end this and say we looked back. And as we look forward, we need to remember, revisit and remember. Thank you both so much. Thank you for bringing the story and the sound, Alan. And people can, of course, see it online with the internet.
Oh, yes.
You can find that speech. And Dr. Palermo, your books are, I do want to let folks know, Robert F. Kennedy and the Death of American Idealism, and In His Own Right, The Political Odyssey of Robert Kennedy. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio.